Cover a subject that could very well be classified as preaching to the choir, because most of what I'm going to present to you, we already well know. The thing is, those who listen to our messages online or those who get our CDs are not all as familiar with the subject and not familiar with the terms that we use. And I think it helps a lot for us to recognize exactly what it is that has been revealed to us in this season of the year. God refers to the fall holy days as a time to come before Him rejoicing with the tenth of our increase. We are to bring the results of our harvest and come before Him. The message of the fall holy days is largely a message of the harvest. And it's His harvest, but it's only typified by our own. In Hebrews chapter 6, there are what we call the six fundamentals of the Christian religion. And I don't know if we've ever called out the fact that in these six, three of them refer more directly to the spring occasion, what is pictured in the spring season holy days, and the latter three picture more what is revealed in the fall holy days. The first three, of course, faith, repentance, and baptism. And we could include with that the receipt of God's Spirit. The latter three, the laying on of hands, the resurrections of the dead, I'm reading from Hebrews 6, verse 2, and the resurrection of the dead and of eternal judgment. The fall holy days deal a lot more with the final harvest of the world, and they have everything to do with the receipt of God's Spirit on a broad scale, the resurrections of the dead, and of eternal judgment. That is the underlying theme that's woven through the fall holy days. Now, we have just rehearsed them once again. We often talk about these things. And we should. And we understand their meaning more than any other Christian organization or any Christian denomination. And that's what we need to realize, and that's what we need to impress upon ourselves and others, that God has revealed a great deal to us through His holy days, and especially how He plans to deal with the rest of the world in a time period that I call beyond Armageddon. The world and the world's religions, especially those that are involved in prophecy, focus on or tend to focus on what is called the Battle of Armageddon. You'll hear those terms used and misused, especially more and more often misused than used, all the time. Even the secular world uses the word apocalypse, or they refer to Armageddon, not knowing what it is. Apocalypse, of course, means the revealing. It's just a Greek word. It means revelation. But they tend to use it as some dire, destructive event. Armageddon, the same thing. They look at Armageddon as the end of the world, when it's not. And that's why I produced this booklet, and I'm going to use some of the terms that are in it. Beyond Armageddon, understanding the prophesied final judgment of the world. The world doesn't understand this. I've sort of prepared this And looking at it retrospectively, I didn't realize at the time, but it reflects these final three fundamental doctrines mentioned in Hebrews 6. It ties together the resurrections of the dead, the millennial kingdom, and the eternal judgment. This book is sort of a synopsis of all of those subjects. Now, I prepared it for a group of people who don't understand as we understand, but I want to make the point, and the booklet makes the point, that there is an era beyond Armageddon. Armageddon is not the end of the world. And in our discussions of the subject, in our messages in the fall season, we tend to use a number of terms. And I'm going to go through each of these terms. It's in the back of this booklet. I call it a glossary of terms. And they are presented in their general order of occurrence. Most of us understand what these terms mean. But a great number of people in the Christian world don't have a clear picture of what they actually do mean. And there's many of them in the latter part of this subject that they don't understand at all. And when they're hearing what we say, and we use one of these terms, which makes sense to us, which we understand, if they don't understand it, there's a great chance that they'll miss the whole point of what we're talking about. So I think to be familiar with each of these terms in this glossary, it's important that we understand what they mean, so that when we hear them, we don't miss the point and we don't lose the point that the speaker is trying to make. So let me go through these. This is going to be rather elementary to many of us. It's going to be something that we well know. But keep in mind, not everybody knows these things. And we need to make them known so that they can follow the understanding that we've been given from God through His holy seasons about how He plans to deal with the rest of the world right up to the point of final sentencing, beyond which there will be no physical human beings left on earth. There will be no death. There will be no grave. We'll read of the passage that talks about that. But the first term that is largely understood in the Protestant world, at least, is the term called the Great Tribulation. That is a series of prophesied world events unprecedented in all of history. We think we've had some rough ages in the past. There's an age coming that is unlike anything the world has ever seen in its severity and in its massive population destruction. The Great Tribulation is an unprecedented event which impacts the world population greatly and is largely the doing of a great beast power, endorsed and upheld by a great false religious power. The tribulation culminates with what is called the Battle of Armageddon on a great plain 55 miles northwest of Jerusalem. And we can read of that in Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22. Mark 13, 19, and 20, and Revelation 13, 1 and 8. And I can make copies of this if any of you want to have it afterwards. But let's look at one of them. Let's go to Matthew 24 just as a quick base to touch here. Matthew 24, verse 21. And here's where it says, "For then shall be great tribulation such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should be no flesh saved, but for the elect's sake those days shall be shortened." The Great Tribulation is unlike anything the world has ever seen. Another term that's commonly used, and I think commonly understood, is the Second Coming. The Second Coming is that point in world history when Jesus Christ returns to the earth to put an end to the beast power and to take control of all the nations, ethnicities, and languages. The beast will be defeated in the field, and his headquarters city will be incinerated. The site of his descent will be to the Mount of Olives, east of Jerusalem. We can read that in Luke 21, verse 25. Luke 21. And these are the events just prior to Christ's return. And there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars and upon the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Christ's second coming puts an end to what we call the Great Tribulation. Now, there are those groups who think the tribulation is going to be 7 years. There are others who think it's going to be about 3.5 years. That has been long been our teaching, the latter 3.5 years, with 2.5 being Satan's work, and the final year being what we call the day of the Lord, and that is those series of events where we see Christ intervening to bring an end to the great tribulation, but which in its own right will bring tribulation on the people who are causing all of this problem. That has been our understanding and our teaching. But the second coming is that point in time when all of the tribulation comes to an end, when Christ takes power over all the nations and puts down all resistance. That is not necessarily how the world understands Christ's return. They tend to look at it as more of a snatching away of the saints on the earth, taking them out of this earth, and who knows what after that. We understand that Christ's return is to the earth. He is to remain on the earth, and he is to begin that period of time which we call the 1,000 years, the millennium. But with Christ's return, we have another term called the first resurrection. And again, I think this one is pretty well understood in the religious world, that concurrent with the second coming, the saints of God will be raised from their graves, or if living, they'll be instantly changed into their incorruptible spirit form, and will meet the descending Christ in the air. 1 Corinthians 15:42 through 54 explains that. 1 Thessalonians 4:13-18 explains it. Revelation 14:1-5. And many other places. With Christ's return, we will see the destruction of the beast and his army. Having moved his second headquarters to the Jerusalem area, which we can read of in Daniel 11:45, the beast's army will be defeated on the plains of Megiddo. That's what is called Armageddon. The beast and his deceiving cohort, the false prophet, will both be cast alive into the lake of fire. These are both living human beings at the time, but are empowered by Satan. There are many verses that refer to that event. Revelation 16:12 to 16, Revelation 17:7 through 18:24, and Revelation 19:21. All of these refer to the beast and his army and the end of his reign. The next event is the binding of Satan for 1,000 years. Revelation 20, the first couple of verses, describes that very well. Satan and all his demons will be captured and incarcerated, being isolated and kept away from the surviving humanity for the duration of the 1,000 years. The millennial age will be without satanic influence. That's rather clear. After Satan is bound, there's an important series of messages delivered to the survivors of the Great Tribulation. There will be survivors. even though the death toll is going to be heavy, there will be survivors. And three angels deliver a message to them, and we can find that in the middle of Revelation chapter 14. Revelation 14 is a very interesting chapter, and I've spoken on that separately on another occasion. But let's just look at one aspect of this message. Begins in verse 6. The first five verses refers to the 144,000 standing with Christ on Mount Zion. So we know where we are in time. This is just after the first resurrection. But of those who survive physically, a message is sent to them. It begins in verse 6. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment is come. And worship Him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. What we need to notice in that is that this message is presenting the everlasting gospel to all of those survivors. And the message is to worship Him who made heaven and earth. Worship the Creator. And it also says, for the hour of His judgment is come. What does that mean? What kind of judgment are we talking about? We know in another verse in the book of Peter that talks about judgment is begun at the house of God. Now we know judgment in that sense is not talking about condemnation. It's not a condemnative judgment. It is a period of evaluation. In this message to the survivors of the Great Tribulation and their descendants, the message is worship God. And the period of their judgment has begun. So this is the point in time when they have salvation opened to them. They have understanding opened to them. In verse 8, there's a second message. And there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. This again ties us to a point in time. This is when the beast's headquarters has already been destroyed. And then the third angel's message. Verse 9, and the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, If any man worship the beast and his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same will drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. This is uttering a prohibition against any kind of false religion from that point forward. So the angel's three messages announced to the world, worship God, Babylon is gone, don't ever do that again. And thus begins the millennial age. That's another term that we use. And it's simply that period of 1,000 years in which Christ will reign on earth with His Spirit-born saints. Many scriptures talk about that. Revelation 5, Revelation 20, Daniel 2, Daniel 7. During this time, there will be no resurrections. And we know that from Revelation chapter 5. Let's just look at that momentarily. Revelation 20, and it's in verse 5. This is after the first resurrection is accomplished. It says, But the rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years were finished. That earlier resurrection, of course, is the first resurrection. But he's saying there will be no more resurrections until after the 1,000 years. After the end of the 1,000 years, there's another amazing event to occur, and that's called Satan's release. And that also is related in Revelation chapter 20, verse 3 and verses 7 through 10. As the millennial age is drawing to a close, Satan will be released, and he will find a great number of supporters, amazingly, who will join with him in a campaign against the world capital at Jerusalem. His vast army will be exterminated, and he will join the beast and the false prophet in the lake of fire, to be isolated from contact with humanity forever thereafter. This will serve the purpose of culling out of the late millennial society all who resent God and his ways, preparing to bring up the vast billions for their opportunity for conversion in the second resurrection era. With that resentful, unconverted element removed from that society, the world will then be ready for the next event. So God is going to cleanse that final generation living in the millennial age from its rebellious element, because those people who are of the final generation in the millennium are going to live on over into that same era of time in which multiple billions are raised to have the opportunity for conversion that they never had. And that is what we call the second resurrection. Granted, scriptures don't number them. We do. But if we know there's a first, and this is the one that comes after the first, which is after the 1,000 years. So in the second resurrection, with Satan permanently banished from contact, that segment of the rest of the dead will be restored to a physical life in order to pursue conversion free of satanic influences. They're going to have the same societal climate that the people living in the millennial age did. It will never be easier to become converted. And if they don't become converted, it is entirely their own fault. We presume that the vast majority will become converted. But the second resurrection provides that opportunity that so many from this generation, from this era, never had. We can think of many, many thousands who died never having had opportunity. Either they lived before the time of Christ, or they died in infancy, or they died prior to completing their conversion, or simply they never heard the truth. There are people on earth today who have no idea that such a person as Christ exists. Never heard it. The societies they live in wouldn't permit it to be made known. So there are many people who never had an opportunity for salvation. God has a plan for them. And that is what we call the second resurrection, or the second resurrection era. Those people are restored back to physical life. They're allowed to live out the remainder of their lives. We don't know how long. There's a verse that some think tells us it will be a century. It could be. Certainly the people who live during the millennium will have a full length lifetimes with good health laws. There's no reason why they wouldn't live to the century mark. There's a verse in Isaiah 65, verse 20, that tends to suggest to us that that's the interval of time that people will live during that era. It could very well be. However long the second resurrection era is, I'm certainly of the opinion that it's at least one full generation, whether that's 25 years or 40, or whether it's a century, I don't know that we can say for sure. But the point is, these people will have the opportunity to become converted. And at the end of that age, the rest will rise to join with them for sentencing. But I'm getting ahead of the story by saying that. So we have the second resurrection era. And another term used is what I call the post-millennial era. In other words, that's that age beyond the 1,000 years. There is a brief age beyond the 1,000 years. And that's what we focus on as the purpose or the teaching of the last great day. The post-millennial age. It's that period following the millennial age assigned to those who come up in the second resurrection. It spans between the second resurrection and the third. Other terms for it are the great white throne judgment, the last great day, and the second resurrection era. They're all basically terms for the same thing. Each of these identifies the same interval of time. There's another term we use, the great white throne judgment. People, when they see that word judgment, always think of condemnation or sentencing to condemnation. We need to understand that judgment involves evaluation before sentencing. In any court proceeding, you wouldn't expect to go into court and be sentenced as the first thing. There is always the evidentiary period. The lawyers present your side. Your opponent's lawyers present their side. And either a jury or a judge comes to a conclusion. Judgment involves the entire thing. It involves hearing the evidence, and it involves coming to a conclusion based on that evidence. The Great White Throne Judgment is a period of time where each individual is evaluated based on what he knows, what he does with what he knows, based on his life's record. It wouldn't be right to sentence someone who has never been evaluated. The whole idea says you have to know the person, you have to know their record in order to provide a just sentence upon them. So the Great White Throne Judgment is that period of time following the millennium that begins with the second resurrection and ends with the third. And it gives those people the opportunity for salvation. Now there's also the term the last great day. That is another term for the same period of time. We celebrate the last great day, understanding that it involves that period of time beyond the second resurrection. That period of time beyond the millennium, following the release of Satan and the defeat of his army, as they surround Jerusalem, which at the time is the world capital. Satan's army is drawn primarily from Asian populations, if you notice that passage. Not like the beast's armies who are drawn from European sources. But the day begins with the second resurrection and extends through to the third resurrection. Now there's some people who object to this name being applied to the eighth day. They prefer to call it the eighth day, which is fine, that's what it is. It's the eighth day. Obviously the day beyond the seven-day Feast of Tabernacles. But no matter what you call it, what happens during that period of time is the same, despite whatever name we may put upon it. I happen to like the term the last great day with the question to those who believe otherwise, what is so great about day seven of the feast? What happens on day seven that we could call great or last? Well, last maybe in the sense that it's number seven of 7 days. But what's great about it? What happens in it? God didn't even make it an annual Sabbath. To me, the second resurrection, the opportunity for salvation, and the final sentencing are great events. So I think the term the last great day is far more appropriate for that period of time of the post-millennial era. And then we come to the third resurrection. This gives people some heartburn. Not too many people understand about it or why it's necessary. The third resurrection is that date in which all who remain in their graves, those who died during the millennial age, and the wicked from the millennial age and the premillennial ages, they will be resurrected to stand with those people who came up in the second resurrection, who remain alive still towards the end of their opportunity period. But these other dead are raised to join with them for that important event, which we call final sentencing. The third resurrection is that event that Jesus Christ spoke of in Matthew chapter 25, the latter part of that chapter. It begins in verse 31. And we need to get this picture in our minds. No matter how you understand the end time events, you need to ask yourself and you need to answer, when does this happen? Verse 31, Matthew 25. When the Son of Man shall come in His glory and all the holy angels with Him, then shall He sit upon the throne of His glory, and before Him shall be gathered all nations, and He shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. This is that sheep from the goats event. When are all nations going to be raised together, commingled, needing to be separated one from another? Is that the first resurrection? No, that's saints only. Is it the second? No, the second is people who never had an opportunity, whose situation isn't determined yet because they haven't been evaluated. It can only be the third. The third resurrection is that point in time where all people who have ever lived, who have ever died, are brought back to life to stand before God's throne and to be sentenced, whether to a good destiny or to destruction. Verse 33, and He shall set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the king say unto them on His right hand, Come, you blessed of My Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. And He goes on to explain why. The basis of their evaluation, we could say. Drop down to verse 41. Then shall He say also unto them on the left hand, Depart from Me, you cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was an hungered, and you gave Me no meat, etc. He gives the basis of their evaluation. Verse 45. Then shall He answer them, saying, Truly I say unto you, inasmuch as you did it not unto one of the least of these My brethren, you did it not unto Me. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. That is the sheep from the goats event. Do we know when that occurs? We should. We certainly have enough revealed to us. I don't think the world can place that in time as accurately, because they don't understand these other fundamental elements. But God has revealed the resurrections to us. He has revealed the final sentencing to us. And that is the benefit of observing the fall holy days, because they illustrate all of these things. In Revelation chapter 14... there is an overlay that I personally feel is very comparable to what we just read in Matthew 25. And it's the latter third of the chapter. And here's an event that you don't hear much about. It's in chapter 14, verse 14. It's what we call the white cloud reaping, or the white cloud harvest. How often do we hear this expounded upon? But here it is, plain English. And I looked, verse 14, and behold, a white cloud. And upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, saying, Thrust in your sickle and reap, for the time is come for you to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. This is that point in time when those people who have been converted during all of the various ages from the second coming on, this is when they are reaped for the family of God. This is the white cloud harvest. So we're basically told how and when this event is going to happen. And then this one, like the Son of Man, leaves the scene. He doesn't participate in the next phase. Verse 17, And another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, and he also having a sharp sickle. He's not going to harvest these former people. His assignment is to deal with the later people, the ones still left standing. And another angel came, which had the power over fire, and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, Thrust in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. Fully ripe. You can't expect them to ripen anymore. There's no point in delaying this. There's no point in carrying it on further. You can't expect these people to become any more ripened than they already are. So we know where we are in time. This is the final stage of the harvest periods that God has intended for humanity. And that angel thrust in his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden without the city, and blood came out of the winepress, even under the horse bridles by the space of 1,600 furlongs. 200 miles is going to be that stream of blood flowing. That's incredible. Absolutely incredible. But here we see two phases of the final harvest. We have the white cloud reaping of those that Christ harvests for his family. And then we have the winepress reaping for those who are destined to God's wrath. Then we have the term the lake of fire, something that's been used in various times in various ways. But the lake of fire is that body of burning sulfur, aka brimstone, which consumes both body and spirit. Those who have rejected salvation and proved themselves incorrigible will become extinct in this consuming flame. Many scriptures refer to it, Revelation 21:8, Revelation 20:14 and 15, Revelation 19, verse 20. With that accomplished, we have to ask ourselves, then what? All human beings who have ever lived at this point in time will have been judged. There are no more people to be converted. There are no more people to be condemned. There are no more people to be harvested. What then? What happens after the lake of fire? With that event completed, we have the thing called conquest of death. With the final judgment or the final sentencing completed, those beings remaining alive will all be spirit-born saints, no longer subject to death. The institution of death in the grave will then be no longer necessary and will themselves be brought to extinction in the lake of fire, Revelation 20, verse 14. Can we comprehend what this is saying to us? This just isn't fancy prose. this is a real event, where he says, "And death and the grave were cast into the lake of fire." This is the second death. There is no more need for, there is no more use for the institutions of death and the grave. Any remaining alive at that point in time will be spirit beings, not subject to death and the grave. There'll be no more need for it. So it also is going to be folded into the lake of fire and will disappear. Can we comprehend that? But then what? But then what? Ah, here's the interesting part. It's found in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 of all places. 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul gives us a little glimpse into the world beyond the world tomorrow. Keep in mind, back in Psalm 110, Christ was given a mandate. He was told that he was to rule until he conquered every enemy. And the final enemy to be conquered is death. Let me just read that briefly. I think it's important to the context here. Psalm 110, very famous passage. I want to read it rather than just quote it. Psalm 110, verse 1. "The Lord said unto my Lord, Sit you at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool." He is to sit at the Father's right hand until a certain point in time. And that certain point in time is when every enemy is conquered. And the last enemy to be conquered is death. And when all who have ever lived and died have been sentenced to either life or death, there will be no more people subject to death. There will be no grave. There will be no institution of death. With that mandate completed, Jesus Christ will turn over to his Father the family. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 25 and 6. "For he must reign till he has put all enemies under his feet. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death." And we just read when that's going to happen. "For he has put all things under his feet," but when he says all things are put under him, it's obvious that he's exempt himself. It is manifest that he is accepted, which did put all things under him. So everything is under Christ's jurisdiction except the Father himself. "And when all things shall be subdued unto him, then shall the Son of Man also himself be subject unto him that put all things under him, that God may be all in all." Christ is going to turn the family over to the Father. And where it goes from there is going to be perhaps the most interesting story of all. We're not given a great deal about it, but I think we at least have the picture of what Christ is going to do with his creation, with humanity. He has a plan to harvest everyone who is willing to be harvested for his family. He's revealed that plan to us. And these terms, as we hear them, ought to register in our minds as to what they mean. No, Armageddon is not the end of the world. There is a world greater than anything we can imagine. There are opportunity periods beyond Armageddon that we have yet to fathom. So hopefully this review will give us a better picture of God's plan for humanity. And hopefully it makes sense. I think it should to each of us. But in those areas where we don't understand it, there's certainly room where we need to study, because God has certainly revealed a lot to us.